Why does it seem like, as I'm driving through the foothills, seemingly every day or every other day, that on those single lane roads, I always get stuck behind some fucking Subaru with a handicap sticker on it, or like a fucking 2014 Nissan Versa sedan that's got the entire back bumper ripped off, and there's a Transformer sticker on the back of the tailgate. Like, what the fuck's going on, people? Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to the show. Hey, we're gonna take our next caller now. This is Ben from Vancouver. Hey, Ben, you're on the air.
Hey, John. Hey, I just want to say I really like your show, and I just felt like maybe, you know, if you could give a little more attention to, you know, Canadians and stuff like that, that'd be great.
All right, Ben. Well, thanks for calling in. Now, go fuck yourself. All right, everybody, calm down. It's only Thursday. I'm sure it's a little comfort in your eyes, though. So, and as usual, I'm tooling through the foothills. You could almost set your watch to it, although today is a muggy. Well, as I'm recording this is Wednesday. And, it's raining a little, a tiny, tiny bit, even though it's 91 degrees out. It's like balmy. It's like humid and floridy. It's a little floridy out here. Florida-ish. You know, kind of balmy. Kind of like, it's like a roll-on deodorant out here. It's just gross. I wanted to talk to you today about underprivileged baboons in the Congo. I want to draw some more attention to them. No, actually, I wanted to, of course, as you know, I've been yapping about the police intermittently. Why, I don't know. Well, I guess subliminally, subconsciously, it's like we're reliving the 80s again with all this political turmoil and senile presidents and bad fashion sense and everything in between. But as I'm listening, you know, I'm really listening in depth to a lot of the early stuff. When they were deemed, well, when they disguised themselves as a punk band, which they really weren't. Because I went back and rewatched this documentary that was made with Andy Summers, who's kind of an underappreciated rhythm guitarist, really. Like, when you think about it, he's been around. I forgot he was in, like, with Eric Burdon and the Animals for an album, for their only album, I guess. He played in some psychedelic band. The hell was the name of it? Some fucked up, weird, unpronounceable name. Anyway, so as I'm listening on Spotify, like, they play, they've got a series of songs that are just kind of, there's probably about a dozen and a half that they play routinely that you get used to, and then so you start listening to them, and then the second and third time around, you start picking apart the lyrics or what's going on. You know, there's always, like, really good, like, this is, I guess what they really were was, they blended, like, ska and reggae with a little new wave. So they kind of crafted their own sound. You know, they're pretty unique to their own time period, right? And but the first couple songs, like, it did have a real punk element to it. And as I'm listening to this song, I think both these songs are from the album Flexible Strategies, which is like one of their first kind of ragtag albums that they slapped together. And one of the songs is called Be My Girl Sally. As I'm listening to it, it dawns on me, this song's about an inflatable doll that's just being, like, courted, so to speak. And so that's cool. I like that new spin on love. And then the other one was, what was the other song? Oh, Friends, which is really narrated primarily by Andy Summers. It's really it's more of a spoken word song. And it's about eating your friends. It's about cannibalism. Like, what the fuck? And then they start going into a bunch of songs about, you know, seeking out holy men in the Sahara. So there you go. So I thought, yeah, fuck all that. Just enjoy the songs. But what I really want, it dawned on me, was like, what the fuck? You know, they're kind of individually, they're kind of iconoclastic type figures, you know, like with Sting, with, you know, being, I don't know, when you set the template of nominative determinism over the entity that is Gordon Sumner, like, that's a tough one. Gordon, I don't know too many Gordons. I don't know any Gordons. Hey, Gordo. Yo, Gordy, Gordo. Nobody really names their kid Gordon anymore. This is my baby Gordon. Hello, Gordon. Sting's better. Sting's a better fit, you know? We're used to it. I don't recall ever even being introduced to the notion that, yeah, there's a guy in this band, and his name is Sting. Not the Sting, not, you know, A Sting, not B Sting, not C Sting, just Sting. But definitely, like, he has, you know, he's always kind of boasted that kind of borderline pretentious, too good looking, always fit, you know, I do tantric sex to the Kama Sutra while I'm meditating on top of a sand dune in the Sahara and shit like that, you know, and save the rainforest. We all know, we get it. But then you got Stuart Copeland, who's kind of like the mad scientist of the band. And then Andy Summers is the jovial, easygoing. I don't know, I could be way off. But I thought to myself, you know, that is kind of a, particularly in a trio situation. So you take another example of a good trio, like, say, Nirvana, you know, and you got Kurt Cobain, the introspective kind of student of rock, you know, and slovenly existence, and but funny, but kind of self-effacing, funny, wisecracking, just putting sugar in the gas tank of the record company type style. Then Chris Novoselic, who's probably the quiet, you know, the George Harrison of the group, you know, the dark horse, not much to say, but definitely, you know, socially minded. And then Dave Grohl, who's just the crazy drummer, the fun-loving crazy drummer, who would have thought, you know, like Ringo Starr, who would have thought he would have gone on to do, like, all this stuff on his own, as a soloist, or not a soloist, but as a, you know, outside of the band that made him famous, much like Ringo. Ringo was huge. He's still huge after the Beatles, right? But just the iconoclastic personality types start bouncing around in my brain a little, and I thought, you know, what better. Like, it just came out of nowhere. Like, it just literally just came from nothing. The notion that, well, to me, Animal House is the greatest movie ever made. Okay, it's out there. I said it. These are the thoughts that bounce around in my head, in my skull, as I drive along behind these motherfuckers with the fucking handicap stickers in their Subarus. You know, like, come on. Jesus Christ, people. You know, when you have to, like, slow down, or when you have to speed up, rather, to go as fast as the warning speed on the upcoming turn on the mountain pass, you know, when it says, you know, best to take this turn at 30 and you're only doing 20, like, fuck off. But anyway, getting back to, okay, so Animal House, okay, I watched it the other night, just kind of, it popped up, I'm like, fuck yeah, done deal. And it's got so many good lines and so many iconoclastic characters that you just, like, it's kind of a screwball comedy that goes kind of, I mean, it's got a thread, it's got a narrative that you can follow with an ending that, there's a build up to the ending and then a somewhat kind of celebratory climactic ending. But within that are the great stories of the shoot, the production, the people, the stories, the characters, the directing, the writing. Of course, it's based around, or it was written by a bunch of National Lampoon writers that took a lot of drugs. And so there used to be this magazine called National Lampoon, which is really just a satire, complete satire magazine. Kind of like Mad Magazine, just kind of satirizes most everything, life, TV, society. And from this was born a script written by, I know Douglas Kinney was one of the writers. I think Harold Ramis might have been one of the writers, who was almost the director. But was kind of pushed aside from what I gather, in a real nice, comforting and professional way by Ivan Reitman, who was the producer. Ivan Reitman was the guy that kind of came up with the inception of the whole. He knew all these people. He knew all these people before they were famous. John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, you know, a lot of Canadians. Dan Aykroyd, the guy played D-Day, I can't think of his last name. I always forget his last name. A lot of Canadians, okay? But Harold Ramis, I think, was one of the writers. Harold Ramis was the guy that, I think he ended up, that's why he ended up directing Caddyshack, because Ivan Reitman was like, he couldn't hold him back for much longer, but they gave the role, they gave the helm, the directing helm to John Landis, because he was really he was coming off kind of the most comparable movie prior to anything that Animal House could be, which was this movie called Kentucky Fried Movie, which is just, it's absurd. It's a bunch of non-related shorts that are just absurd, and that was put together by the same guys that did, like, Airplanes. It's a real like Airplane, the movie, like real screwball, you know, Zucker Abrams and Zucker type stuff. So John Landis came off Kentucky Fried Movie, his first movie, which, now this is the same guy that did, then he would go on to do Animal House then, and then he did Blues Brothers, Beverly Hills Cop, Coming to America, God, you name it. I mean, some of the biggest comedies of all, Trading Places, just huge, huge stuff. So, but a lot of it was on the strength of this Kentucky Fried Movie and then Animal House. And then Animal House, of course, was just tailored for just the screwball. It's like a screwball comedy on steroids, because it's so tight. and it's so over the top. Like, so you've got these, like the, one of the best lines in the whole movie, I think, is when Dean Wormer, of course, the archetypal Dean, the evil Dean, who's going to run the fraternity, the Delta House, off campus once and for all, and has put him on double secret probation because they were already on probation. Sounds like my son. Sounds like my kind of, you know, a semester in the life of my son here. And, but he says to Flounder, the new pledge, this poor fat kid Flounder, he goes, fat, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son. It's words to live by. It's true. It's the truth in all of its glory, right? What was the... Oh, and then the other one... Oh, yeah. The other line I really think is poignant and perfect is when he's talking to Greg Marmalard, the head of the rival fraternity, the clean-cut Hitler youth over there on... that are helping try to get rid of the Delta House. Greg Marmalard, he's in the office of Dean Wormer, and Wormer says, you know, we're putting him on double secret probation, so why don't you get with Niedermeyer, who is the other tandem in the Hitler Youth that runs the ROTC program there. He goes, yeah, put Niedermeyer on it. He's a sneaky shit just like you. Like, there's just no bones about it. Like, that would be something I would think that, you know, a college campus dean would say, like, Ben Shapiro when he was, you know, going to whatever school he went to, you know? Because that's just a perfect, like, line for a Ben Shapiro-type character. Because all that kind of translates to the real world, you know? How many fat, drunk, and stupid people are running around our society now, you know, with an education? And so what does that say? But these archetypal, you know, it's brilliant. And it sets the tone early on in the first sequence when they go to the rival fraternity to pledge. And they just kind of get the runaround from Marmalard, which is a great name, too. That's just a great fucking Greg Marmalard. Like, you can picture a Greg Marmalard. That's nominative determinism at its finest, because you can tell, you just know a Greg Marmalade is going to be a total prick, right? And Flounder and Larry Kroger, who's played by C. Thomas, what's his name? Thomas Hulse, yes, who actually went on to win like an Oscar for playing Wolfgang Mozart in Amadeus, right? So great lineage too, you know, great pedigree of actors in this movie. But he plays Larry Kroger, who's Delta Chi nickname is Pinto, and he goes, why Pinto? And Belushi, who gave it to him, goes, he just gives a little burp and goes, why not? So Pinto and Flounder go into the rival fraternity, and they're immediately introduced to all the fringe candidates of the rival fraternity that more than likely won't get in, and they're all sequestered to the most awkward corner of the house. So you've got what looks to be an Indian in a turban, a blind guy, a guy in a wheelchair. I think his name is Sidney Jugdish, and Clayton, that's what it was. Sidney, Clayton, and Jugdish, right, is how they're introduced. And these poor bastards are sitting there. They got no chance at anything. There's not a word said between them, right? And so it's obvious, like, that they... That's why Marmalard introduced the two, you know, Pinto and Flounder, who, you know, are the ubiquitous square pegs in the round hole, right? And so as Flounder breaks free from that laugh-a-minute group, he wanders through and makes an ass of himself, and then bumps back in or bumps into Marmalard again, who takes him back over and reintroduces him to, this time he calls him Sidney Jugless and Clayton. Same guys, haven't said three words again between them. And but it's just brilliant. It's a fucking, because you know that these guys sitting on the couch not saying a word, being kind of again just kind of sequestered to the fringes of this fraternity. Why would you pledge? We had one fraternity at Humboldt State, and it was a joke. They were outnumbered by us, and a couple of them would linger over to our parties, and which, who cares, you know, there's room for everybody, but you know, they just had that stench of fraternity following him in. But those guys that are sitting on that couch in the rival fraternity that are not going to get asked to pledge, you know, they're future tech bros, you know, the guys that you know, the Jeff Bezos of the world and the Elon Musks who read every book in the library and then just decided to take over the world and make rents impossibly high, like six times what they should be in the Bay Area, like a bunch of assholes. Those are the tech bros, okay? So that is the infancy of the tech bro movement there that eventually made their way to the Bay Area and then into, Silicon Valley and then up into parts of Seattle and Portland and took over and fucked up all the controlled rent up there as well. So, and that's what's interesting too, is like, so the college that they're at, it's called Faber College. Well, it's really University of Oregon, which is actually kind of cool. I don't know. It's kind of an interesting little piece of trivia there. University of Oregon, they just had the world championships in track and field there. And so that's really all I can say for that. I mean, that's just kind of an interesting little tidbit of info. But like I say, the archetypal characters that surface in this movie are fucking iconic. So you got Hoover, who's like the pledge. I think he's the Delta president, who is civic minded but still parties, but has the right motivation. That's not whether he executes it or not, is he's got the right idea in mind, you know, to despite the fact that their house is just chaos. It looks like a punk paradise. It looks like the police lived there while they were in their punk phase and just spray painted like obscenities all over the wall. The couches look, half of them look duct taped and burned. The ones that weren't fully burned were repaired with duct tape. The house is in disrepair. It's chaos at every moment. So as Flounder and Pinto, you know, soon realize that they're not going to be able to pledge the rival fraternity, they make their way out and walk towards the Delta House, where Flounder informs Pinto that, you know, Delta has to take him because he's a legacy. His brother Fred was in the Delta House. And so once they arrive to the front doorstep, they meet John Blutarski, a.k.a. Bluto, a.k.a. John Belushi, who's out front taking a piss, holding a cauldron of beer. And when his attention is diverted to the two potential pledges, he turns around and just consequently showers their pant leg with his urine. And then a mannequin body is thrown out the top window of the fraternity house and lands in front of him. So it's a good time will be had by all. So the main characters of Tim Matheson, who I think Chevy Chase was supposed to play Tim Matheson's character, but Tim Matheson, they couldn't have found a better. Like he's just perfect. He's perfect. He's like that. He's that. He's kind of this arrogant, little wisecracking, but calm, cool, collected, delusional. He doesn't know if he's pre-med or pre-law. Like, as he says in the trial to expel them, like, what's the difference? Pre-med? I thought you were pre-med. Pre-law, pre-med, same difference. So he's he plays the perfect arrogant kind of little prick he's kind of the anti-hero. You know, you kind of like him, but he's a dirtbag. He's a horrible, horrible person, but he's got enough charm to pull it off, right? Very much like Chevy Chase. I think Chevy Chase turned it down because he was already kind of doing other. He was already like a star after a year of Saturday Night Live. He probably was committed to other movies, and then Belushi was signed on, of course, which was his first real movie with a major studio playing a big character. And as the character Bluto, he played the typical, like, just he. I think he was. I think he was pre. I think they're all pre-med. Who knows? And he actually has the greatest article of clothing ever worn by a college student, and that was simply, and I, so much so, I was in such reverence of this sweater that I had to have one made myself, and it's just a simple blue, his was dark blue, a dark blue long sleeve sweater, and on the front it just says college in white letters, or yellow letters, college, just college. It's so perfect. It's like a generic college. It's like a generic college sweatshirt. And I had my parents make me one. I think when I... Was I in high school or was I in college yet? I might have been in college at this point. When they asked me what I wanted for Christmas, I said, I need a blue sweater. And in letters on the front, just put college. And I think they kind of gave me like a weird look. Like, okay. Because what do you expect, right? And so again, he's another iconic character. You know, just this, he's kind of savage. He's a savage. He's just a complete and utter abusive derelict. But he was supposed to be him and Dan Aykroyd were supposed to be in the movie, and Aykroyd pulled out for if I'd read the reason why, I don't recall. But that was taken over, the character of D-Day, by this guy, Bruce, God, I wish I could remember his last name, but he turned out to be a really, really good actor. Like, everybody kind of went on to do some, so, for example, Tim Matheson's character Otter, his buddy Boone, his girlfriend is Karen Allen in the movie. And Karen Allen has been in, like, I mean, I would say three of the biggest, four that I could, off the top of my head, she's been in, of course, Animal House. She was in Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, rather. Huge. She was in Scrooged with Bill Murray. And just recently, she was in... I was watching The Perfect Storm. The one with George Clooney. Based on the book by Sebastian Younger. She was in that. Huge. Just huge movies. So, I think I read where she was from, Yuba City, but that doesn't make sense. So, just scratch that from your memory altogether. But so she plays the stereotypical archetypal girlfriend, college girlfriend, who puts up with her boyfriend's hijinks of, you know, toga parties and just enduring this typical savagery of college life, right? And that exists. I know it. for a fact. When we were watching it, my lady's like, did you ever go to parties like that? I said, yeah, they were held in my apartment. Yeah, so, but what's really cool, okay, so they really did their homework on this. One of the funnier, more relatable scenes, of course, is by, because Donald, and then all of a sudden Donald Sutherland is in it. He's like another one of those under the radar, most interesting Renaissance men of the world, who's, you know, been in movies with, you know, with all the greats. He was in The Dirty Dozen with John Cassavetes and Charles Bronson and Lee Marvin, and he's been in Fellini movies. I mean, he's worked with Federico Fellini. What the fuck? He was in he was in Casanova with by Fellini, the great Italian director. He's just been everywhere. I even read a story where, like, he housed the expatriate criminal writer and thief Jean Genet, the banned French writer, and he just, you know, he just was housed at Donald Sutherland's house. Like, I'm like, Donald Sutherland, the guy that's in Animal House, is harboring fugitive French writers. Like, how fucking weird and cool and interesting is that? So that's Donald Sutherland. So he plays the teacher, professor, slash guy that's been writing a novel for the last 3 years. And so as they're at his little two-bedroom, little 1,000-square-foot college professor house in Eugene, Oregon, you know, the ubiquitous little two-bedroom, little old cabinets, old face frame cabinets, and Karen Allen, and then Pinto, and who else was it? And Boone, of course, go over to his house to smoke pot. And so he's got that crazy look in his eye. He's like, have any of you ever smoked pot before? It's so typical, like, you find that one interesting professor that just is going to smoke pot with you, and then you start having those weird conversations about, you know, the size of a universe being a microscopic molecule that's just embedded in your fingernail that is harboring other universes within itself, you know. And it's so cliche, but it's so college, because that's what you did. Like, I remember at a party dragging random people into my room just to play the Doors song The End, because I thought, well, this will blow their minds. And we sat there, it's a 10-minute song, just listening to Jim Morrison drone on about an Oedipal complex, and how he wants to kill his father and have sex with his mother. And, you know, you're just kind of sharing this with the rest of, you know, a select handful of people from a party at your apartment. And then we all sauntered out and carried on with our lives. Yeah, college is weird, man. Just so you know. So, but that's great. Like, Donald Sutherland, like, is not a, I guess, well, I shouldn't say he's not a comedic actor, because he was brilliant in MASH. The movie MASH, that was the Robert Altman film about the Korean doctors, that actually won the best picture at the Cannes Film Festival. So he's one of those guys that you kind of overlook, you don't think about right away as far as great actors, because there's never been, like, this huge campaign to, like, get him an Oscar or get him a this or that. He just wants to make great films, and MASH was a great one. That was a fucking great movie. I mean, I'd watch that anytime. And, but it's dark comedy, and that's what he did, and he pulled it off. That's hard to do as well, to pull off. If you're an actor, a theatrical actor, to pull off comedy is hard. It's like a 1,500-meter runner a great 1500 meter runner can ultimately turn into a good, if not great, marathoner. But a great marathoner can't do the opposite, can't go the other way and become a great miler in 15. It just doesn't work. And that's the same, I would think, to be said for a real theatrical actor, a thespian, if you will, you know, a serious actor. It's harder for them, I would say, to do comedy because of the comedic timing. You either have it or you don't, right? It can't be, I don't think it can be learned. But a great comedian can certainly do thought-provoking, real theatrical, cinematic stuff. You know, look at Jim Carrey. Look at Michael Keaton. Look at Jamie Foxx. I mean, there's three great examples right there. But to go the opposite direction is very hard. I mean, props to Donald Sutherland. Just a real interesting character. You know, you always wonder, like, what's going on? You know, and his son Kiefer, like, I don't know, did they get along? Do they hate each other? What's the story with that? I don't get it. Like, I don't know. It's fascinating. I think I would like to do a whole podcast just on Donald Sutherland. But anyway, he plays the stereotypical archetypal professor who gets his students high and then has an affair with Karen Allen, which is, it's so funny. It's so cliched, but it's true. All that shit's true. And then, of course, you've got the supporting characters like Douglas Niedermeyer, who's, I can't think of that guy's name who plays him, but he's also in he does a riff on the same character in a Twisted Sister video, you know, a pledge pin on your uniform, drop and give me 20, you pathetic sack of shit. Classic stuff. Like, he just plays that typical, like, fascist, you know, secretly wants to be a Nazi type ROTC captain riding around on his horse, just demeaning, punching down on the, you know, the shiftless, aimless, fat, drunken, stupid future of America, you know. It's just it's that fucking movie. It kind of, I guess, does it work today? I guess that would be the real question. Does it really work today? Because it's so different now. Like, we're so, I don't know. I think we're less, we're more devoid of character now, it would appear, because of our addiction to social media and stuff. It kind of drains the necessity for experience. For experiences to dictate our character, you know, because when you go through enough humility and enough kind of just sideways events and situations, you tend to become a resilient kind of character in and of itself. But if all you look at is the screen of a computer, like these tech bros, do any of the tech bros, do these motherfuckers have it? An ounce of personality? If you did a collection, if you passed the hat, could you fill that hat up to the brim with any personality? These badge wearing fucking geeks that, you know, you can even when they try and dress fashionable, it looks forced. They've got no frame of reference other than it's just they talk fucking movies or binge watched series. Or code. I don't know what they talk about. They just talk about how they're going to gentrify a city and run the artists out of the community, right? They're the first. They're like the gatekeepers to the apocalypse, these motherfuckers. They're the ones in charge of AI and just the mess that we're dealing with now with sentient AI and TikTok apps that have algorithms that, you know, according to the terms of service, can access whatever keystrokes you have on your home PC, your own keyboard, your other, I mean, it, it, Is that what's going on now? Are these guys so, were they so maligned back in the day? You know, they were so punked out by the quarterback of the football team or something that they became a Jeff Bezos where, like, they were forcing, you know, it's kind of a, is it a reverse fascism that they're unaware of? Fuck these tech bros. But it's just archetype, you know, it's different now. You know, I was talking about how, like, there's a reverse discrimination suit going on, and I don't know if it's still going on, but with Harvard, they were limiting the amount of Asian students entering, and I think the basis for it was lack of rounded character. Like, they're great, they're brilliant, they can do anything on paper, they can read anything and apply it in practical terms to anything and anyone, but if you try and have a conversation with them, I think they'll implode. I think they'll fold faster than Superman on laundry day. They don't know what funny kind of self-effacing. Well, they don't. I don't know. I mean, are they really yucking it up? Are you really kind of like staying tuned to see what you're, you know, what the debate team or the computer information systems team is, what they're going to come out with next? No, I don't think you are. You know, their hero is like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, this guy. They made a whole movie about him, The Social Network. Go see it. Fucking, what's his name? David Fincher. Perfectly skewered the rise of the tech bro, who in its inception is the embodiment of this guy that in the guise of Mark Zuckerberg had, you know, a vehement problem relating to women, and so that, I guess, carried over into his social life, which was clunky at best. So he stole this concept for acquiring friends online from the Winklevoss twins, who was they were running an inner campus digital network that was the framework for Facebook. So that's and then force everyone to adopt his thinking on life. That's the revenge of the tech bros right there. That's Zuckerberg. And I don't know, maybe he's a cool dude. I don't know. He comes off as a robot. I think he's a sentient robot, though. You know? I guess we'll never really... I don't know. But, yeah, Animal House is perfect. I guess it does hold... In my opinion, I think it does hold up. And I think people should... I think it should be required viewing. And I think they should... I think they should do what Quentin Tarantino did with his last movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and that is to serialize it or put it in book form, but flesh out the characters. Give the big, you know, half dozen major characters in that movie like a backstory. You know, you want Otter's backstory. You kind of want Boone's backstory. You definitely want Bluto's backstory. Where did he come from? You know, was he raised in Chicago like Belushi? Or was he raised in some Slavic farm in Estonia where he had to milk chickens? I don't know. You want Flounder's backstory. You want Pinto's backstory. You want Donald Sutherland's backstory, the professor, this pot-smoking professor who, when asked about his book, you know, he says, I'm writing a book. And Pinto asks him, how long, you know, he goes, I've been writing a book for the last 3 years or 5 years. He goes, oh, Pinto says, it must be a great book. And Donald Sutherland goes, it's a piece of shit. That's so, you know, it's kind of like the that makes me think of like the Wonder Years, you know, that movie with Michael Douglas and Robert Downey Jr., which is an overlooked masterpiece, I think, with Tobey Maguire as the square peg in the round hole, but he's kind of on the spectrum. He's sexually ambivalent, as well as kind of a genius writer, but isn't seeking any kind of notoriety, but his talents are recognized by Michael Douglas, who's a professor, a ne'er-do-well professor, a pot-smoking professor as well, writing a shit book that he's been working on for like the last 8 years, and it's about 1,000 pages, and nobody's going to read it. It's fucking... That is the essence of the prototypical English lit professor, or comparative lit professor, you know? The guy that's forced every damn semester to dust off Dickens and or some Jane Austen book, you know, Pride and Prejudice, or some fucking Great Expectations. You always got to read Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, and you got to read about Pip and Miss Havisham and Estella and all that shit every December. It's baked into my brain. I have no choice but to reflexively reach for that book every December and read the first half of it. And it makes me think of December, because it was forced down our throats every December by some ne'er-do-well English lit professor who wanted to be a great writer but had to settle for being a reasonably, if not inadequate, English literature professor at a mid-level college. So, fair enough. But yeah, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll write the book. Damn, you know, that's a good idea. I think that's what I might do. I think I'm gonna write. Yeah, I think I found the inspiration for my next big project. I think I'm gonna write a book about Animal House, based on the characters of Animal House, and I'm gonna straight steal it. I'm gonna straight get sued for copyright infringement, and that'll be my my promotional gimmick, my free advertising, you know, because any press is good press, right? So, I had to go down that road. I had to do it. I had to speak on Animal House because that is the launch point. If Animal House didn't, without Animal House, you couldn't have Van Wilder. You couldn't have Caddyshack. You couldn't have the Blues Brothers. You couldn't have Knocked Up. You couldn't have Superbad. All those movies, because of the new fucking woke tech bro mentality, they're not going to make movies like that anymore. They're not going to do it. They're not going to make all the Judd Apatow movies that are just too over the top, 40-year-old virgin. You can't do that. You can't do that anymore. I defy you to show me a movie that is going to happen like that anymore. The only person that could probably pull that off would be Quentin Tarantino, because he just says fuck you, you know, when they wanted him to do some kind of edit for the Chinese version of might have been Kill Bill, or maybe it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, something to do with the Bruce Lee character and his depiction of the Bruce Lee character, which wasn't very flattering. He's told him to fuck off. Fucking great. I love it. So, yeah, I think he's it. I think he's the last of him, David Fincher, Christopher Nolan. Those are the last great American filmmakers that would be able to do something like that. But in today's climate, yeah, you can't make movies anymore like Animal House. You can't, you know, Caddyshack. You can't do Stripes. You can't make Stripes anymore. Somebody's going to be offended. Some some maligned snot-nosed kid who has been coddled to their whole life, in a sea of 800 million people, will be the one dissenting voice that would keep something like a movie like Animal House or Caddyshack or Stripes or Fletch or to keep stuff like that from being made, 40-year-old virgin, you know? And to those people I say fuck you. I say fuck you. Like Mike Myers said in So I Married an Axe Murderer, the Scottish tend to, they don't really have a, they've got their own form of martial arts, which it's called fuck you, which basically all it involves is just catching somebody off guard and headbutting him. So there you have it, folks. I'll leave you with a little homework. Go watch Animal House, because that's the way life used to be, right? That's the way life used to be. And those days are gone, man. They're gone. They're gone, bro. Party's over. Party's over, said the pretty girl. Okay. Yeah, you can't make those movies anymore. You can't make Weird Science. You can't make 16 Candles. Or some nerd. Some... See, like... the Anthony Michael Hall character. Vacation. You can't make another movie like Vacation. But the Anthony Michael Hall character in 16 Candles walking out of the men's bathroom stall with what's her name's Melly Ringwald's underwear. I don't think you can do that anymore. Fuck you guys. Fuck you guys. The end. I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies. Hold on. Point of parliamentary procedure, as Otter says in his in the trial to get Delta kicked out. Point of parliamentary procedure. I have to back up. I have to clarify. First of all, the third best line in the movie Animal House is when... I forgot to mention Flounder. Flounder, whose name in the movie is Kent Dorfman. Not his real name. His real name is Stephen First. But he's Kent Dorfman in Animal House, but his Delta Chi pin name is Flounder. So when Flounder and Pinto are at the rival frat's house trying to pledge, and he gets reintroduced to Sidney Jugdish, who then becomes Jugless, and then Clayton, he says, I remember this, this is the third best line of the whole movie. He says, oh, we've already met. And Marlard goes, oh, great, then you'll have lots to talk about. But point of parliamentary procedure, correction to the latter part of the conversation in my retelling of the story here is I accidentally called the movie Wonder Boys. I called it Wonder Years, but it's Wonder Boys. That's a great movie. Michael Douglas, Robert Downey Jr., Tobey Maguire. Go see it. All right. Is that enough for you? Is that enough for you beggars? All right. Hope you enjoy it. I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.